When I come to, I hear laughter. The sound of an old engine idling. Doors opening and closing, heavy doors. The truck from Beck's driveway, it must have followed me here. I open my eyes and I'm blinded by a flood of orange light. A voice says, "Look who it is." I squint. My vision is blurry, but I see two, maybe three silhouettes moving towards me, casting long, low shadows in the throw of a single headlight. "Looking for your girlfriend, you queer fuck?" My stomach clenches. I recognize that voice. I raise a hand to shield my eyes from the light. There are three of them. A broad-shouldered guy with stringy hair stands closest to me. Next to him is a smaller kid. The glare of the headlight casts an auburn halo around his head and whites out the lenses of his wire-rim glasses. Behind them, lingering close to the truck, is the tallest of the three. I see him in silhouette, his arm posed in an awkwardly formal angle. "I asked you a question," he says. He steps into the spill of the headlight, and I see that his arm is in a cast. Panic grips me. It's Jim Vickers. I try to swallow, but my throat is dry. Maybe they just came here to drink. Maybe they'll only harass me and then let me leave. I'll just go, I turn, intending to roll off the hood and put the van between them and me. "Wait up," Vickers says, his voice eerily gentle, and then a hand grabs my ankle. My heart spasms in my chest. I roll onto my stomach, trying to pull myself away, but he yanks on my foot, pulling me back toward him. My fingers grip the gap between the hood and the side of the car. I can't let him trap me. I have to get free. Vickers grunts, yanks harder on my leg. One hand slips, but I regain my grip. "Cole," Vickers says, "help me out." I feel a hand grab my other ankle. I struggle to kick, but the hands are too strong. "Oh, come on," Vickers says, almost laughing. They pull hard, and my palms make a squeaking noise as I'm dragged backward across the hood. My toes touch asphalt, and then someone slams my face down on the warm metal, bending me over the hood. "You have the right to remain silent," the long-haired one says. There's laughter. I struggle to stand, but the hands push me back down. "Hurry up, you guys," a third voice says. "I don't want to get caught." "Shut up, Grady," Vickers says. "Anybody want to take bets on what we got here? I got $10 on chick." "That thing is too ugly to have a pussy." Another laugh. Then Vickers says, "One way to find out." I feel a hand grip my upper thigh and I scream. Another hand covers my mouth. I thrash on the hood, kicking wildly. "Grady, get over here!" The third boy moves. "Pin the arms!" My arms are pulled apart and I'm pinned so that I'm spread-eagled on the hood. Someone takes a fistful of my hair. And then his face is against my neck, his dry lips on my skin, his breath reeking of beer. He whispers, "Not so tough now, are you, fucking freak?" My head is slammed against the hood again. Stars pop in my vision. I feel my body slacken. He presses against me harder, stubble abrading my cheek, foul breath in my face. His hand grips my thigh, then moves up to reach between my legs. "What do you got down here, huh? What do you got for me?" I find just one word. "Please," I say. My voice sounds weak, thin. "Please." He turns his head. "Kill the lights." Someone lets go of my arm, but I don't thrash. I don't cry out. I just hold still. The headlight goes out. His thumb hooks the waistband of my underwear. I feel the cool night air against my skin. I focus on the smooth, warm metal beneath my cheek. I stare at the windshield, watching the reflection of the flickering sodium lamp appear and disappear. And then all at once, everything lights up. Camera flashes, I think vaguely. They've come to take pictures. But the light doesn't fade. And then he's off me. The hands release me and I hear footsteps moving away. Doors slamming, the truck reversing, then peeling out on the crumbling asphalt. I want to move, but my whole body is numb. I just stay there for a moment, spread across the hood, and then I feel my shoulders start to shake. But it's not me crying. It's some other Riley. I roll onto my side and slide down the side of the van to the pavement. And then a huge hand touches my shoulder, and I scream. "Riley, it's okay, it's okay." It's Solo's voice. I look up. Cello and Beck are standing over me. You're going to be okay. Chapter 30. I sit in the passenger seat of Solo's car with my arms wrapped around my knees. Beck tries to hold my hand from the back seat, but I don't want to stop hugging my legs. Solo tells me they're taking me to the Park Hills Community Hospital. I thought there was a special place at hospitals for things like this. There isn't. I sit in the waiting room at the ER. Solo talks to the woman behind the counter, and Beck holds my hand. There's an old man with an oxygen tank sitting across from me. Against the far wall, a baby is screaming. A woman in a brown sweater tries to make it stop. I let go of Beck's hand to cover my ears, and I close my eyes. I'm in a big room with 10 other beds. I'm concealed from the other patients by a thin blue curtain, but the random shadows moving beyond it only make me feel more exposed. Finally, the curtain is pulled aside and a tall woman enters. She has a long, dark ponytail and a red blouse under her white coat. She tells me her name, Dr. Amala, and asks permission to examine me. I feel myself nod. She pulls on a pair of blue silicone gloves. She frowns as she works, as though she's cleaning up an unpleasant mess. My mother arrives before the police. I don't want to see her. Officer Dinning is polite and gentle, but it doesn't matter. I hardly feel anything. I feel like a mannequin, like the parts being poked and prodded and inspected don't even belong to me. I have to lie down for the swabs. My stomach cramps. I'm okay until the police officer starts taking photographs. When the first flash goes off, I flinch hard, knocking the exam kit off the metal cart and scattering its contents on the floor. Dr. Amala recites some soothing phrases. A nurse heaves an exasperated sigh as she collects the spilled contents and hurries off to get a fresh exam kit. Officer Dinning waits while I regain my composure. You okay? I nod, but I keep my eyes closed for the rest of the photos. I think I talk to my mother. I don't remember what we say. Finally, they offer me something to make me sleep. I take it. I hear my father's voice and I open my eyes. He's leaning over me, his face puffy. When our eyes meet, he lets out a breath as if he's been holding it for a long time. He squeezes my hand but says nothing. I drift back to sleep. When I wake up again, I'm in a different part of the hospital. The lights are off and the room is empty. There's a window, but the blinds are drawn. I can hear the hum of machines and the sound of arguing voices in the hallway. I try to sit up, but a sharp pain in my abdomen stops me, so I lie back and fish around for the bed's controls. I find the remote and raise the bed until I'm in a sitting position. My head aches, and I reach up to inspect my face. There's a big, square bandage on my left temple and another on my cheek. My lips are chapped, my tongue thick. I turn my head to look for water and realize my whole head is thick. Whatever they gave me to put me to sleep has left me extremely groggy. There's a plastic cup on the table next to the bed. I reach for it and miss, knocking it to the floor with a clatter. The door opens and my father and a nurse rush into the room. I squint as the lights come on. My dad leans over me and takes my hand while the nurse pours me another cup of water, which I sip through a straw. Hey, Riley, Dad says. I can't look at him. I'll be right outside if you need anything, the nurse says, then leaves, closing the door behind her. How are you feeling? My father asks. I start to answer, but I can't find words. I shrug. He nods. Your mother is here, he says. She's sedated. When we heard, she... Well, we both... His face goes hard. Jason Solomona spoke with the police. They told us what happened. I mean, everything they could. Dad frowns, shakes his head. Riley, I'm so sorry. I want to nod, to say it's okay. I expect myself to. But something stops me and I just look at him and take another sip of water. His eyes sadden, then go dull. What can I do for you? It comes out a whisper, almost a prayer. I've never heard my dad's voice sound like that. Weak, almost helpless. Anger courses through me, heating my face and making my whole head throb. What right does he have to be weak, to not know what to do? But I can't say any of this, not out loud. So I just shake my head and close my eyes. After a while, a nurse comes in to give me another sedative. When I wake the next day, the grogginess is gone, but I'm sore all over. My head throbs, my legs ache, and there's a deep heat in my abdomen as though I've swallowed a burning coal. I open my eyes, blink, and then my mother is at my side, straightening my blankets and brushing hair from my forehead and fluffing my pillow and 100 other things at once, the rustle of her clothing like the flapping of moths' wings. It doesn't feel like care, it feels like correcting. As though I should have straightened the blankets myself before she came, and fixed my own hair, made myself presentable so she wouldn't have to see me like this. As she pulls away to look at me, she fixes me with a soft expression of compassion and remorse, and I suppress a sudden urge to reach up and slap her. She leans forward and presses her lips to my forehead. It's how she used to tell whether I had a fever when I was little. Now her lips feel cold and foreign on my skin. And I just hold still until she's done. When she sits back, her expression hasn't changed, but something underneath is gone. The look is somehow emptier. "How are you feeling, honey?" she asks. "Okay," I say, fishing for the remote. Mom finds it first and offers it to me. I snatch it away with more force than I intended. She flinches. "I'm so sorry I wasn't here when you woke up." I shrug. "I don't remember it anyway, I was too doped up." She smiles. I bite back the urge to tell her it's a lie. "Do you have my phone?" She shakes her head. "I'm sorry, in the rush to get here, we just..." Then, off my look of disappointment, "I'll have your father bring it." I nod. "Are Beck and Solo still here?" "Solo stayed until 3, but we finally persuaded him to go home and get some sleep. He promised he'd come back today." I nod. "What about Beck?" She shakes her head. "I'm sorry, honey, I haven't seen her. But they weren't letting any visitors in, just family. I'm sure she'll be here later." I nod, but I'm not sure at all. Something about the way Beck acted when we got to the hospital, the way she avoided my eyes, makes me think she won't come. "Can I have some more water?" I say. Mom smiles and refills my cup, and then we talk. Not about me, or about what happened, or about anything important. We talk about hospital food, and how it rained last night for the first time since June, and she promises to bring my laptop and some Blu-rays since I'll probably be here for one more night. It's all so fake I can hardly stand it. Like taking a bite of rice and finding that your mouth is full of hot plastic. I just want to spit it all out, to throw it up and scream at her. And then she looks at me, and her face sort of contorts as if someone is stabbing her. And I don't know if it's for me, or for her, or just because she can't hold in everything she's feeling for another moment. But for that split second, she's my mom again. Like before the election, before Pineview, before everything. And I stop talking, and she smiles at me, and I start to sob. She comes to me and I drop my water cup on the bed and just let the tears come. She wraps her arms around me and I feel the tepid water spreading out on the blanket, wetting my leg and soaking through her sweater. I feel her powdered cheek against mine, her earring pressing into my face. The sobbing goes up and up until it becomes a frantic shuddering, and before I know it, the nurse is pulling us apart and injecting something into my IV, and the world goes fuzzy, then white. I wake up again in the late afternoon. Mom is scrunched up in a plastic chair, fast asleep with her head cocked uncomfortably to one side. When my dad sees that my eyes are open, he nudges her and they pull their chairs up next to the bed. "You slept for a long time," Mom says. "Must be good stuff they're piping in," Dad says. He leans in as if to disconnect my IV. "Can I have a hit?" I don't feel like smiling, but I try. The effect on my parents is palpable. My mom lets out a little laugh, sob, and covers her mouth. My dad's shoulders relax. "How are you feeling?" he says. I feel like if someone asks me that one more time, I'm going to start throwing things. My parents look at each other. My mother licks her lips, and my dad clears his throat. "Riley, we want you to know that..." I cut them off. "Can we not... not right now? Not in here?" My mom's face falls. My dad looks relieved. "Okay," Dad says. "Yeah, of course." He glances at the door. "Riley," he says, "the police want to take a statement." "No," I say. "Riley, sweetheart, the longer you wait, the more chance they'll..." "No!" It's almost a shout. Mom puts a hand on Dad's knee. "Okay, honey," she says. "Not till you're ready." "Thank you." Dad glances at the door. "I don't know if you're up for visitors, but Jason Solomona is out there waiting to see you, if you're ready." "Yeah, I want to see Solo." I run a hand through my hair and touch the bandage on my cheek. I turn to Mom. "Mom, can you?" "Of course, honey." Dad leaves, and Mom grabs a handful of paper towels from the bathroom, wets them, and wipes my face. After fidgeting with my hair for a few minutes, she shrugs and smiles as if to say it's hopeless. She helps me adjust the bed to a sitting position, gives me a cherry-flavored antacid from her purse, and kisses my forehead again before leaving and closing the door behind her. Solo peeks his head into the room and looks around. When his eyes land on me, they widen for just a second, and then he recovers himself and pushes open the door. He's carrying a brown shopping bag. "Okay if I come in?" he asks. "Yeah, but can you turn off some of the lights?" Solo finds the switches and flips off one bank of fluorescents. "Better?" "Yeah, thanks." He pulls up one of the chairs, sets down the shopping bag, and puts his elbows on the bed. I flinch a little, and he withdraws. "Sorry," he says, his face going pale. "No, it's okay. I'm just twitchy today." Gingerly, he leans against the bed again, and this time I don't flinch. He starts to say something, but I cut him off. "Please don't ask how I'm feeling." He digs into his pocket. "Actually, I was going to ask if you want a Starburst." He holds up a fistful of pink candies and flashes me his goofiest grin. "Yeah," I say. There's an uncomfortable silence as the two of us chew our Starbursts. Finally, I break it. "Did Beck come with you?" Solo starts to speak, then stops and shakes his head. "What's wrong?" "Last night, after they admitted you, she said she was sorry and that she had to go." "Have you talked to her today?" "I've called her and texted her about a million times. She's not answering." He shrugs. "I don't know what's going on. Maybe it was all just too intense for her. I mean..." He trails off, looking embarrassed. A cold gray ache creeps into my head. She's disgusted. That's the thought that comes into my mind. I know it's probably wrong, but I think it anyway. She knows what happened, and she's disgusted by me. "I don't want to talk about it." I say it suddenly and more fiercely than I intended. Solo's eyebrows go up. "Okay." He shifts in his chair, then glances around the room as if inspecting it. "I just came to make sure the hospital kitchen is meeting your culinary needs as a vegan." I roll my eyes. "I don't think the hospital kitchen is meeting anyone's culinary needs." Solo laughs, then reaches into his shopping bag and pulls out a stack of DVDs. "I have all the Harry Potters, the first 4 discs of Battlestar Galactica, and season 7 of Doctor Who." "What, no Star Wars?" Solo sighs. "I wanted to bring the original, unaltered, episode 4, in which my namesake shoots first, as our Lord and Savior intended." "Why didn't you?" "I only have it on VHS, and my dad's old VHS player broke halfway through the summer." "Well, I've never watched Doctor Who." Solo drops his jaw, then covers his mouth in mock concern, as though I've just told him I have a terminal disease. "We're going to get through this," he says, laying one big hand on my arm. I know he's joking about me not having watched Doctor Who, but it sort of lands on me wrong. And all of a sudden, I'm crying again. I pull my arm away and cover my face. Solo doesn't touch me, but he leans in close. He speaks softly, but his voice isn't pitying or sad, it's just matter of fact. I think this is going to happen for a while, he says. Things making you cry for no reason. There's nothing wrong with it. My mom says crying is just your body expelling all the bad stuff, like a sneeze. Like your soul sneezing. And just like that, my sobs turn into laughter. It's a sort of horrible, hysterical laughter, but it's better than crying. Soul Sneeze, I say, gasping for air, is the name of my new punk band. We eat roughly a metric ton of Starbursts and watch 5 straight episodes of Doctor Who. Dad comes in after an hour and tells me he has to leave, but that he'll be back before dinner. I tell Mom she can go with him, but she insists on staying. She doesn't come in, though. She sits in the waiting room, catching up on her magazine reading. I text back, but she doesn't reply. When dinner comes, Dad pops in to say hi, then leaves us alone again. Before he closes the door, he gives Solo this look that makes it completely obvious that he now thinks Solo is my boyfriend. I wonder silently if my parents will ever understand anything. Nurses come in twice to give me meds and check my vitals. Solo eats my Jell-O. Finally, a nurse comes in and tells him he has 10 more minutes before visiting hours are over. When the door shuts behind her, Solo turns to me, his eyes serious. I want to say something, he says. I say, okay, but I'm not sure I want to hear it. Solo glances at his lap and presses his lips together like he does when he's playing video games, then looks up at me. I'm sorry for what I said. I frown, confused. What you said about what? Back at the Reagan years. His voice is deeper than usual. I told you that you invited it. By the way you dress, remember? I told you that you were asking for a fight, inviting people to... He clears his throat. And I want you to know, that's bullshit. And it was not okay to say that. I look at him. His face, usually cheerful, even goofy, is now grim. Thank you, I say, for saying that. And for being here. Solo smiles. Then he reaches into the shopping bag at his feet. When he comes up again, he's holding a furry brown bundle. For a moment, I think he's brought an animal into the hospital, and then I realize what it is. His Chewbacca backpack. I want you to have this, he says, but his grip on it seems to tighten. I reach out and stroke the soft, plush fur, remembering how Solo made it sound like no big deal that he stopped wearing it. But he kept it. After all the harassment, he kept it. No way, I say, shaking my head. That's your freak flag. I've already got one. He frowns at me, then looks down at the plush Chewbacca face. His frown relaxes, and slowly the corners of his mouth turn up in a relieved smile. He was ready to give it to me, but I think he really wanted to keep it. Solo, I say. He looks up. How did you... I mean, you got there right when... How did we know where to find you? He asks. I nod. How did you even know something was happening? Beck called me. She saw on the internet what happened at your dad's fundraiser. She was kind of freaking out, said you weren't answering your phone. She told me to come get her, so I did. And you came straight to me? Solo shakes his head. We went to your house, but your parents said you'd already left. We got really worried. I wanted to try Beck's house again. I figured you would go there. I did, I say, but I went to Bullet Hole first. We checked there, too. We must have barely missed you. But when you weren't there, Beck just seemed to know where to go. Solo swallows hard. She was acting weird. I mean, I was worried, too, but she was freaking out like she knew something bad was going to happen. He looks up at my IV pole. She was right. I stare down at the pale green sheet covering me. How could she have known? Did you know she had a transgender sister? I ask. Solo nods. Maybe that has something to do with how she reacted. Solo blinks at me as if he's processing the information. Maybe, he says. We sit quietly for a minute, and then he reaches into his bag again. Last Starburst? We split it, and Solo promises to come over and watch more Doctor Who with me once I'm home. When he leaves, 5 minutes later, Solo is wearing his backpack. Chapter 31. I'm finally discharged Thursday morning. Mom arranges for a substitute to take her classes so she can stay home with me. Each time she comes to check on me, she insists on throwing open the curtains to let in the sun, and then I have to get up and close them after she leaves. The light bothers my eyes. Finally, I snap at her and she stops. I'm afraid to watch TV or go on the internet. I don't want to hear what they're saying about me, and I don't want to know how badly my situation has impacted Dad's campaign. So instead, I finish season 7 of Doctor Who, and then Solo brings the next two when he stops by after school with my government homework. I ask about Beck, but he hasn't heard from her. He acts nonchalant about it. She's pulled this disappearing act before. But there's something in his eyes that tells me he thinks this time is different. And so do I. That night, it takes forever to fall asleep. And when I finally do, I have horrible nightmares. They're dark and heavy and vivid, but the details evaporate when I wake, and I'm left only with the looming sense that something terrible is going to happen. At one point, I wake myself up shouting, and Dad comes in and gives me a sleeping pill. On Friday, two detectives show up at my house, but I refuse to see them. Dad argues with me, even lays a whole guilt trip on me about preventing future incidents, but I just shut down and stare at the wall. Eventually, they go away. By Saturday, I'm able to come downstairs and eat breakfast with Mom and Dad. I want it to be normal, but it's not. Dad always watches the news in the morning, especially this close to an election. But today, the TV is off, for my benefit, I'm sure, and the silence is unbearable. On top of that, Mom and Dad are acting strangely, leaving a wide berth when they pass each other in the hallway. I hear them arguing at night. I'm sure it's about me. I can't fight the feeling that this is all my fault, that I caused this, that somehow I provoked him to do this, I don't want to think of his name, by humiliating him in front of his friends, by re-breaking his arm, by refusing to just be normal. My dad was right. I shouldn't have put my most personal thoughts out in public where they could be read by anyone. I feel so stupid for not realizing what a risk that was, not just to me, but to him and his campaign. I'm sure I've damaged his chances at re-election. I'm ashamed, too, that my parents have to keep taking care of me. I'm a burden to them now, a broken thing, a weight dragging them toward the edge of a cliff. And they can't bear to let go, so I pull them down with me. Dr. Ann says guilt and shame are normal reactions to what I've been through. She encourages me to do my own research online and talk to my parents about it, but I'm not ready for that. The most important thing, she says, is to interrupt my thoughts when I'm feeling those things, and to identify that they're not true, that they're just a reaction to what happened. Post-traumatic stress. It's hard to believe her. I see Dr. Ann on Saturday, then again on Monday. I don't feel better, really, just clearer. In my head, I understand what's happening, and I can see the steps to getting through it. But in my guts, in my heart, I'm lost. Like I'm out in the middle of the ocean, swimming as hard as I can with no hope of land and no sign of progress. I see no shoreline, only an infinite, unbroken horizon, and the dark, dark water beneath. At dinner Tuesday night, the silence is too much. Dad shouldn't be home. He should be out at events and press conferences, and my mom should be with him. I'm not ready to face all that myself, not yet, but that shouldn't hold them back. Dad eats slowly, saying nothing. Mom pushes cooked carrots around her plate with her fork. I have to do something, to say something, or things are only going to get worse. Finally, I clear my throat. They look up at me, surprised and expectant. "What do the polls look like?" I ask. Dad glances at Mom, then back at me. "Riley, that should be the last thing on your mind right now." "I'd rather not think about the first thing on my mind anymore." Dad blinks, swallows. I put down my fork. "I want to talk about something else, something real. I want to know." Mom strokes her wine glass nervously with her thumb. "Honey, what's going on? It's not your fault." "Just tell me," I snap. "I'm not a child. I can handle it." Then, more softly, "Please." They exchange another glance. Finally, my dad looks me in the eye and speaks. "Gutierrez is up 12 points. The pundits are saying it's going to be tight. I nod. I figured as much. Then, still looking Dad in the eye, I say, "Is it because of me?" Dad's mouth drops open slightly, but he recovers quickly. "No, it's..." He shakes his head. "That's how these things can go. It's a conservative county. Any kind of story like this..." He trails off, looking at my mother for support. One part of me appreciates that he's trying to protect me, but another part is angry at him for thinking I'm too weak to face the truth. Mom reaches for my hand, but I withdraw it. The hurt in her eyes just makes me angrier. She thinks I'm weak, too. "You're more important to us than all of that," Mom says. "Far more important," Dad echoes. I nod, feeling heat start to build up behind my eyes. Dad clears his throat. "I know you're still processing all of this, and I don't want to push you, but if you don't talk to that detective soon, they won't be able to..." I stand up abruptly, cutting him off. "I'm not doing this right now." Dad's face goes red. "You can't just give up like this." "Oh," I say, my voice breaking. "And what about you? It's okay for you to give up?" "What?" he says. "You should be out campaigning, not sitting here interrogating me about things you can't fix." His face goes white, and when he replies, the words come out in choppy bursts. "Riley, whatever you think, I'm not giving up." I clench my fists. "Well, I'm not either." Mom intervenes. "Stop it," she says, gripping my dad's arm so hard he winces. She looks at me, and there's a ferocity in her eyes I've never seen before. "Okay. You don't have to talk to the police, but you need to talk to us." I look at the two of them sitting there, Dad confused, Mom scared. I think I ought to feel sad or ashamed, but all I can feel is the heat in my face and the tension in my jaw. I take three long breaths. When I open my mouth to talk, the words won't come out, so I just shake my head. Mom rises from her chair, walks over, and puts her arms around me. Dad gets up too and places a hand on my back. We stand there like that for a long time, not talking. Finally, I push away. "I just need to be alone right now," I say. And then, pretending not to see the defeated look on my mother's face, I turn and head up to my room. I put an old Trespassers William record on the turntable, lie back on my bed, and try to lose myself in the ocean of echoing guitars, but my brain won't be quiet. My dad is losing ground in the polls because of me. My best friend, girlfriend, won't return my calls. And the guy who did this to me is walking around free while I'm holed up in my room, hiding from reporters and the police, isolated from everyone. I consider calling Solo, but he'll only try to cheer me up, and that's not what I want right now. I wish I could blog, but that's out of the question. Even if my anonymity hadn't been stolen, it would only take one cruel message to break me into pieces. And I can't fall apart, not again. So I turn off my phone, shove my laptop under the bed, and bury my face in the pillow. I recognize what's happening. I'm isolating myself, just like Dr. Ann warned me I might. I'm withdrawing, closing myself off. I'm acting like a victim. And I hate that word. I hate it. I have to do something. But I don't have the courage to leave the room, let alone face my blog, and the thought of accidentally coming across some news article about what happened makes me physically ill. Still, I can't just lie here. I have to do something. So more out of rage and desperation than a genuine desire to heal, I reach under my bed, retrieve my laptop, and fire it up. And with a couple of carefully crafted Google searches, I start doing the research Dr. Ann prescribed. I find dozens of websites about violence against trans and genderqueer people, but after half an hour of browsing, I end up back on queeralliance.org, reading personal stories written by survivors. Just like Dr. Ann said, many of them went through the same things I'm going through now. The numbness, the isolation, the nightmares, the guilt, the shame, the lack of appetite. It's weird. Part of me is comforted by this information, but another part is angered by the thought that I went through this unthinkable experience only to come out the other side as a stereotypical victim, a statistic who perfectly fits the profile. And then I find a story dated June of this year, a month before I went to Pineview. It's about an 18-year-old trans man named Eduardo who was suffocated by his ex in an Orange County motel room. When I read the name of the motel, a shudder runs down my spine. It's 3 blocks down from the old hardware store where my dad used to take me when I was a kid. I've driven by it dozens, maybe hundreds of times. I drove by it that night. I put a hand on my head, feeling the tender spot where it struck first the windshield and then the hood of my mom's minivan. And that's when it dawns on me. I'm one of the lucky ones, because I survived. I'm surprised to feel a hot surge of anger rising in my throat. I survived, and yet thanks to my famous father, my story has been all over the news. But what about Eduardo's story? How is it possible that a murder like this happened so close and that I never heard about it on the news? Why wasn't this a headline? There are dozens more, but the story that affects me most is about an 8-year-old trans girl in Ohio whose father beat her to death with a chair after she told him, "You know, I'm really a girl inside, right?" I have to wipe away tears to read on. According to one site, over 300 acts of violence have been committed against trans and genderqueer people this year in the U.S. alone, and 30 of the victims were children and teenagers. I can only assume that Andy Gingham is one of them. That is, one of the 30 that were actually reported. The thought that I might be number 31 sends a bolt of cold shooting through me. But the feeling only lasts a moment, and then it's eclipsed once more by anger. A deep, slow-burning rage. At Jim Vickers and his accomplices, yes, but it's bigger than that. It includes Eduardo's ex, Andy Gingham's dad, the father of that 8-year-old girl. And somehow it includes me, too, for sitting here unable or unwilling to do anything about it. But what can I do? Me, who can't even face talking to my parents, let alone the police. I consider Mike Michelle's invitation to speak at the Trans Health Con this weekend, and I shake my head. I don't have the courage to leave my room. How could I possibly stand in front of an audience of brave, out, genderqueer adults and claim to be some kind of online community builder? It's absurd. But then I think about my blog and my 50,000 followers. However unintentionally it came to be, it's an undeniable number. And even though it's only a virtual crowd, when I imagine those 50,000 faces looking at me, I feel invisible bands begin to tighten around my chest. I remember vividly the real crowd of reporters outside the hotel that night. All those faces, all those microphones and cameras, and the pressure builds until I can't breathe, until I just want to disappear. My phone buzzes on the bedside table and I flinch. The display shows Park Hills PD calling for the 4th time today. I never should have given that officer my cell number. Ignoring the call, I slide off the bed and go to the window. I peek out through the curtains and see a news van still idling on the curb across the street. Just when I want to be left alone. Isolated, Dr. Ann would say. I'm surrounded instead. By the police, and the media, and my parents, and by the overwhelming thoughts swarming around in my head. I can't go on like this. I need to talk to someone, someone other than Dr. Ann. And although Solo has been amazing to come see me every day, he's not the one I need. I need Beck. Now. And, since she won't return my calls, I'll have to go to her. Chapter 32. The clock on the dash reads 10:42 p.m. when I pull up to Beck's house, and all the lights are out. I try Beck's phone one more time. It goes straight to voicemail. It's way too late to knock on the door, so using my phone as a flashlight, I walk around the side of the house, fumble with the latch on the gate, and make my way into the small, overgrown backyard. The lights are on in the back window, and there's a small gap in the curtains. I approach the glass and peer in. It's Beck's room, all right, but it's a disheveled mess. Bed unmade, dresser drawers hanging open, books piled on every surface. And there's Beck, sitting on the floor, facing away from the window, staring at a framed photo surrounded by lit candles. Gently, I tap on the glass, and she looks up in surprise. When our eyes meet, I take a step back. Her face is drawn, her eyes hollow. Her hair is short and sticks up in clumps, as though she chopped it off with dull scissors. Finally, she crosses to the window and opens it. "Hi," I say.
"Hi."
Her voice comes out like a croak, as if she hasn't used it all day. Can I come in? She looks up at me, glances back at the door, and then sets about removing the screen from her window. I climb through, and she closes it behind me. Sorry if I scared you, I say. Beck shoves aside a pile of clothes and drops onto her bed. But you weren't answering your phone, and I thought it was too late to ring the doorbell. Beck shrugs. Eric's at my dad's, and my mom took, like, 3 Ambien. She would have slept through it. I lean up against the wall next to her desk. You look worse than I do, I say. I hope to tease a smile out of her, but she just nods. How come you haven't been answering my texts? Beck gestures vaguely at the door. I dropped my phone in the toilet. I didn't want to talk to anyone. She licks her chapped lips and looks up at me. How's your head? It looks worse than it is. I move toward the bed and sit down next to her. I hope she'll take my hand, but she makes no move to touch me. I clear my throat. I want to ask you about what happened that night. As though she's been dreading this, Beck closes her eyes and nods. Did you know it was him? Vickers? Yes. Did you tell the police? She nods again. Then why haven't they arrested him? She punches her thigh with a fist. I knew it was him, but... That night, Solo and I hardly saw anything. Guys running. A truck pulling away. We couldn't see the faces, let alone a license plate. When the detective took our statements at the hospital, he acted like we were wasting his time. Beck buries her face in her hands. It's my fault, she says. What are you talking about? All of it. It's my fault. That's why I couldn't talk to you. My stomach twists, seeming to understand something my mind doesn't grasp yet. When Beck speaks again, her voice is low and she won't meet my eyes. Eric hacked your computer. He found out about your blog. My heart begins to pound. What? The night you came over to study. When he set up the Wi-Fi on your laptop, he stole your browser history. I stare at her. I don't understand. Are you telling me that Eric is the one who outed me, that he called the reporters? No, Beck says. It's more complicated than that. She lets out a long breath. Eric had this fantasy of being on the football team. You saw him working out with that video game. I guess he already knew who you were when you came to the door because he'd overheard Vickers talking about you. So when I handed him your laptop that night, he saw a chance to get in good with the team. He hacked whatever he could and gave it to Vickers as some kind of bribe. I stare down at the patchy brown carpet, trying to process what I'm hearing. I remember spotting the two of them on the athletic field that day. Vickers apparently teaching Eric how to throw. I remember Eric digging something out of his pocket and handing it to him. And then, Beck continues, when we humiliated Vickers at the football game, I guess he just snapped. He had your blog. He knew your name. He must have Googled you, found out who your dad was, read about the fundraiser, and then made his plans to get back at you. My mind is spinning, my face starting to tingle. Eric knew about my blog and gave the info to Vickers, who waited until the right moment to out me, the moment when it would cause the most damage. So, I begin, then pause. There's so much, it's hard to wrap my mind around it. How do you know all this? I ask. Eric told me, she says, but something in her eyes tells me it's not the whole truth. He admitted it to you? She nods. When did you find out? Beck starts to say something, then drops her gaze to her lap. When? My voice sounds hard, and Beck seems to shrink from it. She glances up at the door, then back at me. The night you came over to study. Right after you left, I caught him looking at your blog, and I confronted him. My chest tightens. So you read it? I ask. Beck doesn't respond. Did you read it? She nods. All of it? She nods again, and suddenly I can't breathe. But I made him erase everything he stole, she says. I thought it was gone, I swear. But he must have, emailed it to himself before I caught him. I put a hand on the top of my head as if to hold myself down. The room has begun to tilt. But he didn't tell me the rest until after the... after it happened. I swear, Riley, I'm telling you the truth. But I'm not listening. I can't listen. She read my blog. She knew everything all along. Her invitation to the queue, our dates, what I thought was flirting. Was any of that even real? My heart turns to lead in my chest. I'm sorry, she says. I should have told you sooner. I didn't think... So, I interrupt, my voice trembling. I was just a project to you? Beck's head snaps up. What do you mean? You took pity on me, heat rises to my face. Thought you could fix me. What? No, Riley, you know that's not how it was. I stand up, cutting her off. What do I know? That you invaded my privacy? That you lied to me? Beck opens her mouth as if to reply, but only shakes her head. And when it really counted, when I really needed you, you couldn't face it, so you ran away. I shake my head. Now I'm the one who's disgusted. You never liked me for me. You couldn't save your fucked up sister, so you thought you'd try to save me instead. Beck goes white. I turn and stride to the closet. I dig my fingernails under the edge of the big rainbow decal on the closet door, Gabby's decal, and I tear at it, ripping it off in strips, shredding it. Something pops in my head like a water balloon bursting, and I start to scream. My vision goes blurry. The sound of blood pumping through my ears is deafening. I push away from the closet door and stagger back towards Beck, yelling incoherently. My shins smack into the desk chair and I cry out. I stumble backward and kick the chair as hard as I can, sending paperback books flying. And then Beck is on her feet, wrapping her arms around me, holding me. I thrash against her, slapping her back, trying to kick her, but she just holds me tighter, and my screams turn into wails. My legs give out and I drop, like a rag doll. Beck gets down next to me, not saying anything, just holding me. Just holding me. There's a knock on the door, and a slurred, groggy voice yells, Francesca? What's going on in there? Nothing, Mom, Beck says. I just had a bad dream. Go back to bed. Is that you yelling? Go back to bed, Mom. Her mom mutters a few more incoherent protests, then withdraws. Beck holds me the whole time. Gradually, my breathing slows. My heart rate goes down. I blink as Beck's face comes back into focus. She looks like herself again. Her eyes are still hollow and her chopped hair still sticks up at random, but she's back in control. I have to go check on my mom, she says. Stay here. I'll be right back. She stands and quietly leaves the room. I cross to the bed and my eyes find the framed picture Beck was staring at when I knocked on the window. It's a photo of a beautiful, dark-haired, fine-featured child, about 6 years old, wearing a pair of patent leather Mary Janes. It's Gabby. My phone vibrates in my pocket and I check the display. It's Mom. They must have discovered I left. With a pang of guilt, I decline the call and text her back instead. I'm okay, had to see Beck, home in an hour. Sorry. Beck returns with a cold, wet cloth, and I use it to wipe my face as we both sit back down on her bed. Is she okay? I ask. Yeah, Beck replies. Are you? I look at her. No, I'm pretty not okay. Beck nods, looks away. But I'm more okay than your hair. She groans and runs a hand across her almost buzzed scalp. I'm so pissed I did that. I actually kind of like it, I say. She rubs at it again. I feel like a boy. I smile. I know what you mean. Sometimes. Beck smiles back. That crooked smile. And warmth floods through me. I put the cold cloth against the back of my neck. I'm sorry I said that. About your sister. And about you. Beck shrugs. You were pissed off. There's a long silence as the two of us look at each other. Then she says, When I saw the footage of you online, getting mobbed by reporters outside that hotel, I knew something was going to happen. I called Solo, we went looking for you. He told me, I say. Beck's gaze drops to her lap, and she bites at her lip ring. I didn't know Vickers was going to do what he did, but I thought you might do something. Like Gabby. Yeah. I glance at the photo of Beck's sister and a lump forms in my throat. I haven't talked about why I ended up in Pineview since my first session with Dr. Anne. I swallow and look up at Beck. I already did, I say. She cocks her head. Over the summer, I chased a bottle of Xanax with a glass of my dad's favorite Irish whiskey. Why? A lot of reasons, I guess. I look up at the ceiling. I was into this guy, Derek. He was my friend, and then I made it weird, and he just cut me off. I wasn't on meds yet or in therapy or anything, and it kind of wrecked me. I didn't flush my phone, but I threw it pretty hard, smashed the screen. I show her, she nods. Anyway, I was getting ready for one of my dad's big events, like the fundraiser last week. God, was that only last week? Getting dressed up, it triggers my dysphoria. It was especially bad that night, and it snowballed into a full-on panic attack, and I felt like it would never end, like there was no other way out. Beck nods. I take a deep breath, and then I just keep talking. I tell Beck about Pineview, I tell her about Dr. Anne. When I'm done, Beck starts to speak, but stops herself. What? I ask. You never told me why you transferred. You don't want to hear that sob story. Beck raises her eyebrows. You owe me at least one, or we'll be out of balance. I smile. Fair enough. I lean back against the wall. At Immaculate Heart, I had to take PE. I don't at Park Hills. I used my dad's pull to get it waived. I glance over at Beck. Guess that makes me a hypocrite, huh? No, she says. It makes you smart. I guess. Anyway, I had to change in the locker room in front of other people. That's when I started having really bad anxiety. I couldn't eat. I lost a lot of weight. By the end of sophomore year, I was having panic attacks 2-3 times a week. Wow, Beck says. I nod. Being undressed in front of other people, it's hard. Especially on days when I don't feel like the gender I was assigned at birth, you know? Beck nods, and I wonder if she ever had this conversation with Gabby. So I started wearing my gym clothes under my school uniform every day. You can imagine the harassment. One kid asked me if I was Mormon, and I was hiding my magic underwear. Catholic kids, you know. Obsessed with sex and religion. Beck smiles. Anyway, one day, this was during the last week of sophomore year, I was changing in the locker room and 3 of my classmates came in. They said school was almost out, and before summer vacation started, they wanted to see the magic underwear. I swallow hard. It wasn't enough that I had to wear that fucking uniform every day. It wasn't enough that I changed right in front of them. They wanted to see my genitals. My voice breaks, and it's a few moments before I can go on. I refused. So 2 of them pinned me against the lockers while the other one pulled down my gym shorts so everyone could see. There were 3 other people in the locker room, but no one tried to stop it. They all just watched. One kid was about to take a picture when the coach finally came in and put a stop to it. I expect Beck to act surprised or to try to comfort me, but she doesn't, and I'm grateful. I don't want her pity right now, just her listening. And she seems to know that. At the time, I thought that was the worst thing that would ever happen to me. I watch Beck's jaw tighten. She nods. She gets it. I look out the window at the big sycamore tree just beyond the back fence. The branches are swaying in the strong autumn wind, leaves detaching like skydivers jumping out of a plane. I thought if I changed schools, things would be better. I thought I could get away from people like that. I turn back to Beck. But there are people like that everywhere. Just like there are people like me everywhere. Like Andy Gingham, like your sister. Beck's eyes drift to Gabby's photo. She shifts on the bed, runs a hand over her scalp. I glance up at the shredded rainbow sticker on the closet door. I want to tell Beck everything that's happened to me. Being stalked online, having my locker vandalized, coming out to my parents. And if I could tell anyone about what happened that night, how they held me down, how his stubble felt against my cheek, I would tell Beck. But now isn't the time. Right now, I just want her back. Us back. Riley, Beck says. I look up at her. I'm sorry I didn't stay at the hospital. I'm sorry I left, I just... No, I say, you don't have to apologize. I didn't mean what I said earlier about you running away. You were there when it counted. For a moment, I think Beck is going to cry, but she doesn't. She just takes my hand. My parents are in the kitchen waiting for me when I get home. Mom rushes across the room to embrace me. Oh my God, Riley, we were so worried. She steps back, holding me at arm's length. Her hair is a tangled mess and her eyes are puffy. Don't you ever do that again, you understand me? I'm sorry, Mom, I won't. I glance at Dad, expecting to see his face red with anger, but he looks calm. I needed to see Beck, and I didn't want to talk to you about it first. Dad walks over and puts an arm on Mom's shoulder. Well, now I think it's time we did talk. Mom makes tea, and we sit around the kitchen table with her in the middle, gripping both our hands as though she's afraid the house might tip over and sink. Dad looks at me. You want to start? Okay, I say. But then I just stare at the table, trying to think of what to say. Finally, I speak up. I don't know what you think about me. Mom inhales sharply and grips my hand even tighter. We love you, you know we love you. I know, I say, but that's not what I meant. She glances at my dad. He looks intensely uncomfortable and does his habitual throat clearing before he speaks up. Well, he says, we've only had a few days to process all this, and obviously the circumstances weren't ideal when you told us. I know, I say. Dad continues. And so much has happened since, we really haven't had time to deal with your gender identity stuff. His mouth tightens into a thin line. Okay, I say, but you have to have some reaction, right? Dad blinks, then looks pleadingly at my mother. Well, honey, she says, this is all very new to us. I mean, we understand gay and straight, and we know there are transgender people, but until you said it out loud, neither of us had heard of gender fluid. She glances at him. We had to look it up. Dad grips his mug. Honestly, there's so much information out there, and a lot of it contradicts itself. The pronouns and the terminology, it's very complex, and... Mom cuts in. But we love you no matter what, Riley. You're our child. Dad looks at her, and then he nods. Your mother's right. His eyes meet mine and he says, but you're going to help us navigate this whole thing. We're old and set in our bipolar ways. Binary, Dad, I say. He nods. Right. Binary. And then Mom sort of lunges forward and engulfs me in an awkward, suffocating hug. And after a moment, I hug her back. I expect my shoulders to start shaking, my eyes to start gushing tears, to have some profound catharsis, but apparently I'm cried out for the night. Finally, we release each other. Dad gives me a thin smile. I say, I think I'm ready to talk to the police now. Dad raises his eyebrows. Are you sure? Yeah, I say. But will you stay with me while I call? Of course we will. He says. The line connects on the third ring, and a man's voice asks whom I'd like to be connected with. I say, Officer Dinning, please. Chapter 33. This is the part where I don't ask how you're feeling, Dr. Ann says, taking her usual seat. And this is the part where I tell you I don't know. She makes an uncharacteristic throwaway gesture with one hand. Make something up. I frown. Is this some new tactic to get me talking? Make something up, you mean lie? Dr. Ann glances at her watch. Well, it's a 50-minute session. If you're not going to talk about your feelings, you've got to say something. I blink at her. Something. Dr. N laughs, and then I do too. It's the first time I've laughed without crying since the